I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all here with us here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at the future of food, farming, and our environment. We are listening to Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community from Baltimore, Maryland, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM in Delmarva. And we begin our conversation today looking at the food bill, which is about to pass Congress completely. And then later on, we'll have a debate on GMOs, that labeling that is taking place in the Maryland State Legislature. And right now we are joined by Tim Murphy to open our program. He's a reporter for Mother Jones, runs the Washington, D.C. Bureau. Tim, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
How are you?
Great. I should point out, I don't run the Washington, D.C. Bureau. I'm just a reporter here.
Okay, well, fine. I wanted to give you a raise. And so let's just get an overview of this bill. I was interested when I was looking at this bill. The politics of this bill is what I want to ask you about as you've watched this thing happen. It was very interesting to watch the numbers of congressmen who didn't vote for it, Democrat and Republican, which was asked about in a moment. But to give us some of the politics behind this bill.
Sure. You know, it's a $1 trillion bill, but really what the main focus has been on for really the last 6 or 7 months has been food stamps. The bill has passed, cut $9 billion from the Supplemental Nutrition Program. It was originally, Republicans wanted to cut about $40 billion. So kind of in one view, that's a small victory for liberals. But then when you couple it into the $11 billion that's going to be cut through expiring stimulus funds, you're looking at a pretty serious reduction in services for people who rely on food stamps in, you know, kind of an era of increasing poverty. So that has really kind of been the focal point. When Republicans originally posed the $40 billion in cuts, President Obama said he would veto it. As it is now passed both the Senate and the House, and President Obama is expected to sign it.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the food stamp portion of the bill, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, you're talking about $9 billion cut in food stamps for that bill, $11 billion slashed over 3 years because of stimulus funding ending. There's a huge amount of money. You're talking about the numbers of people who are going to have to cut their may have to cut their food intake, like not getting food. I mean, even though the most severe restrictions were pulled off, this was a really huge, I think, victory in the long run for the Republican Party.
Yeah, and well, it sort of depends on how you look at it. In kind of an ironic twist, you know, and most of the, you know, some of the districts that are hardest hit by these food stamp cuts are also deep red districts, you know, represented by rural Republican congressmen who were pushing for these cuts. But Republicans didn't, of course, get everything they wanted. You know, there were, as my colleague Eric Eichelberger explains at MotherJones.com, there were a number of cuts that they wanted. They wanted, you know, to make it easier for states to drug test as a requirement for food stamps. They wanted to make a permanent ban on convicted felons receiving food stamps, which, you know, of course, in addition to the racial components, impact, you know, millions of people. And they didn't get those. But as it is, we're looking at a 1% cut across the board for SNAP.
So very quickly, one last question here. One of the things I'm curious is your analysis of the no votes. Republicans and Democrats who are no votes. Who were these no votes and why?
Well, the Democrats initially had a plan where they were going, you know, they thought they could kill the bill if they all voted against it, because there are a number of arch-conservative Republicans who think $9 billion a year cut from food stamps
is not enough.
And pocket change. Now, these are the folks that were pushing really hard for $40 billion, or, you know, as the case may have it, just eliminating SNAP entirely, because you don't really need a carrot and the stick, you just need the stick. There's a lot of, you know, vulnerable Democrats in kind of rural areas who obviously really need to have a farm bill approved by the end of the year in an election year. You know, someone like Tim Walz of Minnesota, in a district that went for Mitt Romney, has a real incentive, you know, to get behind a bill that's going to pay out billions of dollars for farmers. So it passes with this coalition of Republican and Democrat.
It was interesting to watch at least progressive Democrats who voted no across the country as well because of the food stamp issue.
Yeah. And you know, again, when you look at how it sort of passes through the Senate, you know, it's a Democrat-controlled chamber. It does speak to the extent to which the Senate is a little undemocratic, and it sort of favors rural areas. And you know, so a place like South Dakota or North Dakota or Iowa will end up with few senators, which is the same as, you know, a place like New York State with a, you know, heavily urban populace. And so that's how you see a lot of these programs, you know, like subsidies for peanut farming, subsidies for rice production in the Deep South, continue to persevere even as SNAP is reduced.
We've been talking with Tim Murphy, reporter for Mother Jones, Washington, D.C. Bureau, joins us once again. Tim, thanks so much, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you.
That was Tim Murphy, as I just said, Mother Jones, Washington, D.C. Bureau. We're now about to talk to four guests here about the Farm Bill in depth. We're joined by Colin O'Neill, who's Director of Government Affairs for the Center of Food Safety, Liana Hoods, Executive Director of the National Organic Coalition, Patty Lavera, Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates the food team, and Justin King joins as Policy Director for Asset Building Program at New America Foundation. Folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This has been an interesting bill. I mean, when I looked at it and saw how the largest grain farmers in America were really happy about the bill, but how upset beef people were, how it kind of shifted things in the organic world a little bit, that experimental program starting in marijuana's non-intoxicating cousin, hemp. So there's been an interesting bill. And Patty, let me begin with you, your analysis of what this bill didn't do.
Well, I mean, this is the kind of exquisite pain of the Farm Bill, right? It's big. It's got an enormous number of moving parts. And this one was particularly painful, I think, for everybody involved. So, you know, they only do it every 5 years because it's so big and it's so hard to do. And this one took, it depends when you say the cycle started, this one took 3 years to finish. So I think a lot of folks were just exhausted with it and done, and they finally cut some deals to make it happen. So in terms of, you know, what we just heard about for low-income families, it's, you know, it's not good news. It could have been worse. The news could have been worse. On other fronts, you know, like getting support for folks doing it a different way in agriculture, organic or specialty crops, there was some good news. But, you know, in the big picture stuff of, like, the commodity programs, how we deal with the major things that agriculture is still producing, you know, the drivers of factory farms for animals and that kind of stuff, there's not real reform here. They shifted some things around, but this was we're mostly characterizing it as a missed opportunity to kind of change some of these structural problems in agriculture that didn't happen in this Farm Bill.
Well, I'm going to come back to that thing you just said. And Justin, what's your take?
Yeah, I have to agree. This bill's the definition of a mixed bag. And if you think about it from an economic perspective, from an opportunity perspective,
mm-hmm.
There are cuts here that are going to hurt some low-income people. That's a bad thing, especially in this economy, as we see more and more workers be eligible for food stamps because their wages are so low and their needs are so great. So we're going to be taking food away from some of those folks, but it's a 1% cut. It's concentrated in 17 states, and it does it in a way that it eliminates some sort of silly practices that states were engaging in. And on the balance, it could be much, much worse.
It's interesting. The LA Times reported on a story that talked about the article was called Farm Bill, Still Millions for Fat Cats in Congress, Cuts for the Poor. Talked about, and this is from about the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C., that talked about the kind of hypocritical debate taking place in Congress, and they used people like Congressman LaMalfa from California, who is a very wealthy farmer who pushed for the subsidies and also pushed for deeper cuts in food stamps and mentioned a number of others, and that 75% of those payments we're talking about will be going, direct payments, will be going to 10%, the wealthiest 10% of the farmers. And that, you know, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that doesn't often hit the light of day, which takes us 3 years to get to a point that, except for the kind of things, a few smaller things, didn't seem to change that much. that we actually saw. Colin?
Well, you know, Mark, I think you hit on a really interesting point, which is that this bill is really riddled with contradictions. And, you know, it goes without saying that the Farm Bill is the most important food policy legislation that Congress considers. And on the whole, it really encompasses all aspects of the food and farming system. And while we do celebrate a few successes today, they're largely wins for keeping bad legislation out of the bill rather than the policy reforms that Patty was alluding to. And so while we, have fought against the King Amendment, which would have nullified a wide swath of state labeling or state laws, we failed to get the reforms needed for the food movement to reform the industrial model of agriculture.
I want to come back to that point you just made and Patty just made. But, Liana, let me ask you this question. One of the things that is interesting in this bill, because everybody has it, people support it, don't support it, because everybody has a piece of something in this bill. So, you know, poultry and meat farmers are upset about one end. Dairy farmers accepted a compromise. And on the end of kind of the new look at farming, organic farmers actually did better in this bill than they've ever done before.
Indeed. Organic agriculture is one of the fastest growing sectors of agriculture, even in the economic downturn, and it also provides health and environmental benefits to everyone. And in this farm bill, there were the core organic programs were funded from the certification cost share, which the maximum an organic farmer could get out of that program, it would be $750. But it does also fixes some of the problems with crop insurance that hasn't worked for organic farmers and provides funding for research and data collection. This was a sector of the farm bill that really was very successful, but there are other parts of organic that would look to making structural changes in our food and agricultural system that weren't that successful, that others have alluded to. But organic in core programs did get great funding in this farm bill more than ever before.
So how do you think that's going to change the nature of that industry, if it will at all?
I think it will encourage our U.S. farmers to meet the unmet demand of organic. Organic's growing so fast that domestically we're not providing what we could to the industry. And so hopefully the certification cost share and crop insurance, for instance, will encourage farmers to certify and to grow for this growing market. The worst thing that could happen is that the market grows so fast that we outsource all of it, and that trend looks like it could grow a little bit, and we'd like to see that stop and have organic farmers in the U.S. Supplying this growth market.
So, I mean, I'm curious what you all think is missing from this bill. I mean, you know, everything from the catfish controversy to looking at meat and poultry farmers or associations being upset because they have to now label where the meat comes from, saying it would be too costly, would hurt their business. Well, let me just ask that question. What is that about? Why were people just upset about that, about labeling their food, where it comes from?
Well, the people that are upset about labeling their food, it's the industry.
But
I don't
why?
Think, because they say that it will raise costs and compliance on them. This is not my area of expertise, but this is a very classic business rejection of regulation on its face, regardless of the benefits for the public.
Well, and if I can hop in here, you know, I think the chief argument against the country of origin labeling, which you're alluding to, Mark, is that, well, first and foremost, Congress passed country of origin labeling over a decade ago. So it's not the efforts by the industry were just to kill it again or try to kill it again. But the industry doesn't want consumers to know what they're eating, and that's the fundamental issue, and that country of origin labeling provides a public good for consumers because they finally can see where their meat and other products are coming from. And with meat, now consumers have information about where that meat was born, raised, and slaughtered. And suddenly consumers are now seeing that their animals, whatever their steak is, was born, raised, and slaughtered in three different countries. And the companies know that consumers are going to react to that information.
You were trying to say what, Patty?
So, yeah, I mean, that's exactly right what Colin just said. I mean, this has been going on since the 90s, and I've personally been working on this issue since 2002, and it's a fascinating coalition. We call it the Cowboy Consumer Coalition because farmers and ranchers want this labeling because they're proud of what they raise, and they want to communicate that to consumers. Consumers want it because they want to know what they're eating. It's the meat packers, the food processors, the food retailers in the middle that don't want it, and this has been a battle for two decades. And interestingly, I mean, this is a topic for a whole other show, mm-hmm. but the lever they're using, they go after this label every time they can. In every federal budget, every year we have to protect country of origin labeling. It took us 6 years once it was originally passed to actually get it to go into effect because the industry went to Congress every year and took away the funding to finish the rules. And now they're going to the World Trade Organization. And so this particular round of this fight was about whether, you know, trade negotiators in Geneva get to say what we know about our food. And so this has been an ongoing battle, and the Farm Bill just provided a venue for them to try to do it behind closed doors.
And this is also, I think, Patty, one of the things you alluded to here, which is really kind of important, but we need to cover again on the show, which we haven't done in a while, which is the ongoing battle between the meatpacking and wholesale retail industry and the men and women who raise the meat in this nation, especially cattle ranchers. I mean, that's part of the root of this battle.
Yeah, and this got tied together. So the fight over cool country of origin labeling was really closely tied at the same time in the Farm Bill to a fight about rules that we've been fighting about since the last Farm Bill in 2008, which is whether the USDA has the authority to regulate contracts between folks that raise livestock and chickens. Like in Maryland, you have a ton of contract poultry growers. They raise those birds on contract to the chicken companies, and the contracts stink. There's not contracts like this in any other sector of our economy. And for years, people have been asking USDA to stop the really most blatantly unfair pieces of it about secrecy in the contracts and binding arbitration, whether or not they can require you know, to spend money and improve your chicken barns without any guarantee you're going to keep their business, et cetera, et cetera. And this has been a battle that the meat and poultry industry has been fighting in the Farm Bill as well because they don't want to be held to fair standards about how they treat their suppliers. So that was very closely tied with the efforts to try to kill country of origin labeling. They were also trying to kill any regulation the USDA might do on these contracts between producers and meatpackers.
Well, listen, does it make a difference to you at 410-319-8888 to know where your meat is coming from? If, in fact, you're an omnivore or carnivore, write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can link onto our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Stein. I'm curious what you think. One of the other large issues in this, I think, was in these controversies had to do with the question of subsidies. I mean, and it's, I think, for a lot of people looking at this who really kind of worry and care about whether or not how much money is being given to people who run farms for growing or not growing food and what's the difference between that and crop insurance, it becomes very foggy for people. What just happened, Colin? What just happened here?
Well, what we had is a subsidy system that was initially direct payments of cash to farmers either who are growing or who owned land and aren't actually even farming that land. And what we substituted it with is now a federal subsidized crop insurance model. So we've just switched how we're giving money to farmers without limiting the amount of money that they're getting or reforming what money they're getting for. I think as Liana mentioned, there is one silver lining, and that was crop insurance with regards to organic, because organic has been, unfortunately, unfairly treated with regard to the money that organic farmers can receive if their crops are damaged.
So do you have a comment on that, Liana, before I turn to another guest?
Yes. This is the use of this crop insurance for organic farmers is when they actually have a loss, and that it is a small piece of the crop insurance program that actually has now been moved into doing more than just the loss of a crop. But organic farmers were treated so that their recovery was on a conventional price, even though they had grown organic product, and they were also paying a lot more for that crop insurance product. So it's good for organic farmers to be able to participate in the crop insurance when they have a loss. On the other hand, what's going on in the wider world of crop insurance is not so good.
So I'm curious, Justin, does this kind of look to you like there's some people have been writing that this is just kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's gone from one pot of money to the other, it really hasn't changed much. Is that true?
Well, you know, and I think you look at the big picture of the bill, you know, the biggest title of this bill is the nutrition assistance. It's the food stamps program. It's SNAP. And while there's stuff to be upset about there, the bottom line is this program is still there, essentially untouched in the form it was before this agreement was reached. And so if we are unfortunate enough to experience another significant economic downturn, this program's going to be there for people. And, you know, there folks have different interests, and there's a lot to complain about here. But there is a bottom line portion of this, particularly for folks that are sort of, you know, on the street that are struggling to make ends meet. We've sort of affirmed for the next 5 years that if you need some assistance, you've got a shot at getting it through the nutrition assistance program. And I think that's good news.
You're talking now with the cut to SNAP.
Yes.
And you're saying that there's some good news in that.
Yeah. I mean, listen, Mark, it's still there. It's a 1% cut. It's not a 10% cut. It's unfortunately concentrated in 17 states or 16 states in the District of Columbia that are going to bear the brunt of those cuts. But there were some radical proposals on the table that really could have reshaped the way that we delivered nutrition assistance. And the way that we do it now is responsive to the economy. And so when the economy goes down, this program steps up. And there were proposals on the table that would have changed that relationship. And we've avoided all of those. And so we still have a responsive nutrition assistance program. Folks that fall on hard times are going to be able to get assistance through SNAP, even with these cuts in place. And I think that's actually, you know, like we said, it's a mixed bag. But if you want to go glass half full, that's a pretty positive way to look at it.
Patty, give us a thought on that before we go to break here.
So on the just to step back to that subsidy piece,
I mean, please.
The subsidies are supposed to be a safety net for farmers when the market's not working. And the market hasn't worked fairly for folks that grow corn and soybeans and grain and all those things in a long, long time. Because we, most places you have just a couple companies buying it. There's been no acknowledgement of that. There's been no antitrust enforcement. And so since the mid-80s and especially the 90s, farm bills have just stepped in to try to keep people from going bankrupt in bad years. What's missing are programs we had many decades ago, and this is this missed opportunity for reform. There was a proposal from the National Farmers Union, which didn't get enough traction in this farm bill, to create a grain reserve, which is what it sounds like. You have a reserve. We have one for oil because we think it's important. We should have one for key farm crops, which, one, gives you some food security, and two, helps farmers weather low prices, and it helps consumers weather high prices. This is the kind of stuff the Farm Bill used to do 30 and 40 years ago, and those programs gradually got taken away. We need them back. So that's what didn't get discussed in this Farm Bill.
So, and that is different from subsidies, because subsidies will help a farmer out in times of drought or if the market crashes and
Well, there's a couple different things. So crop insurance is when you have a problem. You have a failure. Right. There's a, you know, you didn't get a crop in. Subsidies, what ended with this farm bill, for the last several cycles of farm bills, farmers have just been getting a payment no matter what. They had a great year, they got a payment. They had a bad year, they got a payment. And that was a political remedy to an embarrassment that after they threw out a bunch of programs that were supposed to have not have these wild spikes, high or low, they threw those programs out. We started to see the wild spikes. That's bad politically, and these direct payments came along to try to be a Band-Aid for that. Then people tuned in that we were just writing checks to farmers no matter what happened. Those went away in this farm bill, and we shifted everybody to crop insurance. But it's not an adequate substitute for trying to have some policies that make these markets behave a little more predictably.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I do want to hear the other guests think about this idea of grain reserves and whether they should be in there. What would that mean and how that would work in lieu of subsidies for farmers or with them, and see what people think about that. As we're examining the Farm Bill, we're also going to talk about some other issues that came up that we want to kind of define for all of you in this and looking at the bill that's probably passing now as we speak in Congress. Reminding you on the way to this break that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com. We'll be right back with the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and to Soundbites here, our way to look at food, our food system, farming, and our environment here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. And support for this programming is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's marylandeducators.org. And we are joined here by Colin O'Neill, Director of Government Affairs for the Center for Food Safety, Liana Hoods, who is Executive Director of the National Organic Coalition, Patty Lavera, Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates the food team, and Justin King, Policy Director, Asset Building Program, the New America Foundation, 410-319-8888. So let me jump right into this. One of the things let me ask this question first. Justin, maybe you can start off this. Just to comment on what Patty said about the difference between subsidy and having a grain reserve, the contradictions therein, and what your thoughts about that are.
Yeah, you know, I don't know a lot about the details of this, but I think when you look at this bill from a good government perspective, from a sort of man on the street perspective, it's really fair to raise questions about who Congress works for. And I think the ordinary person sort of looks at the way the sausage gets made, pun absolutely intended here, and it's not a pretty picture. And it's hard to come away from this thinking that the public's interests are the ones that are being best served.
Do you have any comments on this, Colin, and then Liana?
Well, you know, I think the issue really should be about that this farm bill continues uncapped, unlimited commodity and crop insurance subsidies for mega farms. And that is a failure to reform, as we've been talking about, and something that was supported on both the House and Senate that, unfortunately, when the bill went to conference, just kind of got abandoned. And so, you know, I think there is a need to go back to some of the successes in previous farm bills, as well as a need to adapt our farm bill now to the growing political food movement that wants pollinator protection, that wants local organic foods, that wants farm-to-school programs that supports better conservation and better food production for Americans.
Liana?
To build on what Colin said, the promise of organic is more than in the marketplace. It provides health and environmental benefits to everybody, and food that is healthier that should be for everybody, yet the amount of investment by this country into this alternative system that could be the system of how we grow is minute. And it's just a small example of how unbalanced this farm bill is and the payments that we make on behalf of our food and agriculture system compared to what we could be doing for what our consumers want and what we all need in terms of health and environment.
So I'm very curious. One of the things that see what you all think about this. One of the things that was in some of the a couple of the articles I read about 20 minutes ago, from the LA Times, when the American Enterprise Institute, again a very conservative think tank in DC, who's been guest on the show many times, said that that their analysis of the new bill says that the cutback in farm aid is the elimination of direct payments to farmers. However, 75% of those payments went to the richest 10% of farm owners. What does that mean? When you look, Patty Lavera, at what the people who farm the land in America, and this says that three-quarters of those payments had gone to 10% of the farm owners, and I don't know how that will shift with these new rules, but what does that mean? I mean, what about the other 90%? Who are they? What do they get?
Well, some of this, I mean, they'll spare you the endless days-long conferences where people fight about how to do these numbers, right? And you can, and it's all anything with government data, who gets a payment, you can chop it up a different way. But there are a couple explanations for this. One is the subsidies that everybody's talking about are for certain crops. So they're for corn, soybeans, wheat, for commodity crops, that, you know, grains and things like that you can store. So they tend to be bigger farms. This is not some, you know, 10-acre farm growing vegetables for your CSA. Those types of farms are not in these subsidy programs. So these tend to be bigger acreage farms, They tend to be, the land tends to be very valuable because the subsidy, for years, we, you know, for many years, we had a direct payment that was coming every year to that farm based on the acreage they had grown in previous years. And so that starts to become a part of the calculation of the value of the land. And it just starts to become this cycle where, and these are also farms that are very mechanized. They're using lots of machinery. They're not using hand labor to pick corn and soybeans, right? So it just becomes this kind of style of the what lots of folks think of as industrialized agriculture. That's who these programs were for. Having said that, there are a lot of mid-sized farms that were still in those programs, but there's lots of very, very, very large farms. And so when you look at the payments that they're getting, they look, you know, it really is, it looks disproportionate. But there's, if you're looking at numbers of farms, there's lots of small farms at the other opposite end of the spectrum that aren't in these programs. If they're growing vegetables, you know, for local marketing, you know, livestock producers aren't in these same programs. So it's really agriculture is more diverse than you think. But if you, that's why lots of these payments were focused on these crops. It goes to what looks like a small number of farms.
So very quickly, we have a few minutes left in this particular segment. We'll come back to this again in coming weeks because we've been covering the Farm Bill pretty intensely over the last couple of years. So what is it that happens now, Justin King, that we need to kind of look at and look for, and we'll go around the room very quickly.
Yeah, I think, you know, defense and sort of holding on to what you've got has been a recurring theme in what people have talked about. And, you know, this bill is, you know, going to pass momentarily. It's going to be the law for the next 5 years. But that doesn't mean that everybody sits and waits until 5 years from now. We had a $5 billion cut from the nutrition assistance program in November. Another $8 billion cut this time around. For folks that care about this, this is a constant job of being engaged and holding on to the good pieces that are still there in the wake of this five-year reauthorization.
And can let's just go around the room very quickly before we have to break. You want to jump in here, Colin, and go to Liana very quickly.
Sure. So, you know, I think one of the great disappointments was the gutting of a vital pollinator protection amendment.
Mm.
As we know, over the past decade, honeybees and other pollinators have been virtually decimated across the country and around the world. And there was an important bipartisan amendment that was agreed to on the House side, supported by senators. It was gutted in the conference committee, we presume, by the pesticide industry. And we will be looking to not only legislation in Congress, but states to be taking up the mantle for pollinator protection. We're going to see the same thing with the labeling of genetically engineered foods, 26 states last year, hopefully more than 30 this year. So I think there's a lot of important state action that's going to help drive the food movement and shape what we wanted to see in the Farm Bill, and we're ultimately disappointed that wasn't in.
Well, I'm afraid we've just run out of time because the next segment we have is up in a pre-recorded debate on GMO labeling we have to put up there. But we'll come back to this. I want to thank you all, Colin O'Neill from Center for Food Safety, Liana Hoods from the National Organic Coalition, Patty Lavera from Food and Water Watch, and Justin King from the New America Foundation. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
There will be a bill introduced into the state legislature to require that genetically engineered food be labeled, that we know what's in the food. And this has caused, as it has across America, quite a controversy. It didn't get out last year. It's being pushed even harder this year. We are joined right now by one senator. Senator Karen Montgomery is a Democrat who represents Maryland's District 14 in Montgomery County, who will be sponsoring legislation that could require the labeling of products with genetically modified components. And shortly, I think, we'll also be joined by Senator J.B. Jennings, a Republican who represents District 7 in Baltimore County and Harford County. Both of them are members of the Education, Health, and Environmental Affairs Committee. And Senator Karen Montgomery, welcome. Good to have you with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Let's start with the GMO labeling bill you're putting in. It had a very difficult time last year, so tell me what's going on this year.
Well, to tell you the truth, I hadn't followed it last year. The bill came up this year, and one of the things that stood out is that we don't have it in this country, and yet at the same time, 64 other countries do. And I mean, they're not tiny countries. It's Japan, China, Australia, Russia, European Union, and a whole bunch of others. And it seemed to me that it was time for the U.S. to kind of fall in and do the kind of labeling that other countries do.
Why do you think that's important?
Why do I think it's important? For a number of reasons. Number one, we do export, and we are, Maryland actually is a very good, excellent farming state. We produce a lot of corn and soybeans, and they are both genetically engineered. I don't have a problem with that, by the way. And we might want to expand, have them go to other markets where they do like labeling. It seems to me we're kind of cutting off our own nose to spite our face not to be able to do it and to make sure all of the markets are open to us that we need.
So what did you mean that when you said you don't have a problem with that? Don't have a problem with what?
I think that some of genetic engineering is probably going to be vital for the future. It is very helpful already in some medicine where we know some particular diseases are caused by certain genes. And if we can either bump out or modify by chemical means some of the genes that may cause terminal diseases, I think it would have been a big gift for mankind. I think some of the things that we are able to do with food, I disagree with the people who destroyed the rice fields that added vitamins to the rice in an area where children really needed those vitamins. I do not think that genetic engineering needs to be regarded with horror. I do think it needs to be studied, learned about, and to know what it does and what it doesn't do. But I certainly would not want to say we won't do genetic engineering, because in the past, not the same way we're doing it now, but we always bred for more production, or in some cases, certain types of color, i.e. in corn, yellow corn, white corn, all of that kind of thing. This is different. It's a different way. It's inserting the genes of some other organism outside of that particular species, in some cases, into another, or to insert some chemicals. But I think in a number of cases, it can be very useful. We just need to understand it more. And for some people who are religious in certain ways, they like to know because they themselves have certain dietary rules and they want to know about whether or not certain things are being mixed in with their food.
I was interested earlier before we went on the air. We were just talking off the air for a moment when you were talking about in your life for a while. You actually did raise animals.
I raised sheep, indeed. And one year, for those who are farmers among us, I passed that magic threshold. I actually made $5,000 that year, so I could deduct the feed and other things. I do, indeed. I was breeding, in many cases, frankly, for size, because I like lamb, and I wanted some great big lamb. And one breed, Corriedales, are huge. They become small pony size, in fact. But I do not have an absolute sense of we can't do this, but I think we need to know about it. I think we need to be able to study it. And we certainly need to get past this bit of, oh, my golly, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to know about it. We need to. We need to make sure we preserve, as we have in some places in the world, the parent seeds, so that all of our crops, if we ever need to, we can go back and kind of start all over again on some crops. And I think this is a rational and scientific way to go about it.
So what does this bill that you're proposing actually do?
Well, the bill does not touch, and I want to clarify that, it doesn't go near meat or poultry. What it does is it says if you do a certain type of genetic engineering, not the usual breeding, but other different kinds of things, that you just say this food was created by genetic engineering. We're not asking them in any way to tell what they've put into it and what DNA and RNA they have put in there. We are not asking them for that. But we are saying to label it and say this either is or is not produced by genetic engineering. Now, one of the neat things that is happening in this country, and we are in a lovely market basket, shall we say, here in Maryland, between a couple of major cities, Washington, Baltimore, we could even stretch as far as Richmond. And we will find, and people are finding, that more and more people are buying food that is, number one, organic, and number two, that more and more people seem to care about what's in their food. And I do think that this is one of the reasons why we need to do some labeling. This bill is not punitive to the suppliers or retailers or manufacturers. It gives them some outs. They do need to label it. But if something comes through that they said isn't genetically engineered and it turns out to be, they are not going to be held responsible. It's a very gentle bill. It just says if it's created with genetic engineering, just say so on the label.
But it's interesting. So this is just for packaged foods, nothing else?
Pretty much. It's also for fresh food that is bought in bulk.
And so where's the controversy lie then?
That's what I'd like to know. I'm having a real problem. I mean, the FDA already labels 4,000 ingredients and additives and processes. They already are doing it. The FDA says if it's dangerous, we don't label the daggone stuff. We take it off the market. I do not understand why some of the farm groups and some of the chemical companies are resisting it. You know, my gut feel is, what, are they ashamed of GMOs? I think they have a source of pride in many cases. This is why I do not understand their opposition.
But you seem, from at least some of the language of the bill, seems to talk to what you see as kind of the dangers, because you, in the bill, it says the cultivation of genetically engineered crops can have serious effects on the environment due to over-application of herbicides on herbicide resistance.
Now, this is an issue that I think we're all be willing to discuss. And I always have said when I do a bill, I like to make sure that all of it can be defended or discussed. And one of the things that there is some knowledge about, and it seems to vary from the source, is some folks say with the genetic engineering that some of the plants you can spread herbicides on them and they will not have a problem and die. Now, others say that because of this, the farmers sometimes, or some groups are, putting on more herbicide than they need to. This is questionable. I'm willing to discuss that. And I do know that there are those who actually say they have proof and can say that we are using more herbicides and pesticides, others who will come up with some ideas and statistics that say we are not. And that is one of the reasons the bill is here, to actually kind of come to the bottom of this rather than do a lot of fussing and yelling and screaming. So we will actually need to get some real numbers, and the numbers need to come from, I guess, sources that tend to not guess, but sources that actually measure.
That's interesting. I'm curious what kind of reception this receiving, though. I mean, because it seems that some people, when this came up in Washington State, when it came up in California and other states that have attempted to pass these bills, the opposition has been intense.
Very. And I think part of it is false statements on whether or not, you know, this is going to hurt business. I don't think this will. I mean, I'm looking at some peanut butter, the jar that occasionally we don't get a chance to eat around here, so we all keep peanut butter. You think I'm kidding?
No, I don't think you're kidding at all.
And it's, you know, it's got hydrogenated vegetable, rapeseed, all of that. Now, I've read some things, and they say hydrogenated stuff is not that good for you. Well, I eat the peanut butter anyhow. You know, people who are afraid it's going to hurt their markets, that's nonsense. I think most people are not going to pay a daggone bit of attention, will continue on eating as they have been. I think it's some people like to get scared, like to fuss and yell and say it's going to destroy this or that in terms of the markets, and that's not the case. But I do think it will protect a market that says this is produced without genetic modification. And I think this is a good thing because we have growing markets for organically produced food.
Now, you have to get this out of committee.
Yes, we do.
But that becomes the issue.
It becomes the issue. And then if it gets out of committee, we have the issue of possibly a long debate on the floor. We have found a lot of the complaints are often footed, based from the companies that produce these GM modifications. There are places like Monsanto that provide master major seeds for many, many large farmers. But we need to protect the market for the small farmers who do not want to do this, and I think this is an important future for agriculture. I hear the argument that that cannot produce enough food for everyone to feed the world, and we'll see. That may or may not be the case. But I do think that we need to protect the market for those who do not care to buy food that may have other organisms in it.
Senator Karen Montgomery, thank you so much for all your time for Soundbites today.
All right, and always interesting to discuss things with you.
Now we're about to talk to Senator J.B. Jennings. He's a Republican who represents Maryland's District 7 in Baltimore County and Harford County, who I guess, I'm supposing, Senator, opposes Karen Montgomery's bill.
I do. It's tough to do in the logistical side of it. You know, for instance, she brought a bill in last year that wanted to list every type of drug that had been used on an animal, such as any type of antibiotic. And as I tried to explain to her, for instance, we'll take cattle, you know, the beef industry. Several different farmers will own that cow over its lifetime, and it's hard to track exactly what that animal had been given. And same thing with this bill. It, logistically, it's just I see it as almost impossible to do.
So one of the arguments that the senator makes, the other senator makes, and people who support the bill make is that, look, this is done in 64 countries around the globe, and many of those countries won't buy our food stuff because it's not labeled, and those countries don't find it onerous. Why is it onerous for us, from your perspective?
I think being 100% accurate on a label is the hard part. It's easy to say, yes, this product may contain GMO-modified food. But just from what my experience is in the industry, it's a tough example. You know, look at corn. You know, when they harvest corn, you have multiple farmers who harvest it, they truck it to a plant, and it gets put into these large grain bins. So you have, you know, fields from all over the region being centrally located in one bin where they will then bag it, package it, or process it, package it, and sell it. How do I know what farmer A was using versus farmer B? I just think logistically it could be tough. She made some valid points, but she and I have talked off the record, and I'm waiting to see the bill hearing, you know, where we go with this, because she has pointed out other countries, and I did not realize that the numbers were that high, but is it 100% accurate is my question with that.
I suppose with larger companies, you know, like when they had the battle over Cheerios, which I guess you read about, and Cheerios decided to take whatever genetically modified grains they were using out of their cereal, so they were able to do that. Clearly, it seems to be something that may be consumer-driven in a large way, where she describes in her bill the kind of growth of organic food industry and the growth of people looking for non-GMO foods, whether you agree with GMO foods or not. What kind of discussions have you had around that?
We didn't get too far into it, mainly because it's just been very busy with other issues that we've been dealing with. You know, in niche markets, yes. I'll give you an example. People love having organic food. My wife buys some organic products herself. And it's easier on a smaller scale. But on a large scale, it's tough. You know, the world has changed. You know, we're feeding more and more people on less and less land. You're having to take these crops, making sure that they can withstand drought or the infections or the disease that's out there. And I'm not an expert in it. I mean, I'm looking at what I've read through different publications and magazines and what I've seen from my own eyes, you know, in the agricultural industry. We can't be as efficient as we are without doing this type of stuff with these products. And people, when they think about it, this GMO, they're thinking that, you know, these chemicals and they're you know, they're thinking the worst thing, and that's not necessarily what it is.
We've covered GMOs for a long time here on Soundbites. The arguments back and forth, even with environmentalists who don't think GMOs are so bad. And it seems like many of those who opposed labeling see it as a step towards banning foods with genetically modified components entirely. Do you?
That has not crossed my mind. That's not my issue. My issue, again, goes back to the logistics of it. Understanding, you know, the way that these grains are processed and harvested and sent to the plant is where I see it being an issue. The outlawing of it, look, I've been in apples long enough. If they want to outlaw it, they're going to do it. You know, whether it's labeled or not, they can pass a law saying you can't plant GMO corn. And that's what they're going to do. So I think that argument, to me, it doesn't stand because they're going to do it no matter what, whether it's labeled or not.
So what do you think about the consumer side of it, who are concerned about food safety and sustainability, losing original seeds, et cetera? What's your as a person in that business? What's your perspective on that?
I understand the concern of the unknown. They don't know it fully. What they're seeing is on Google, or they're seeing these news bits on it, and they don't understand it fully. Having been in the industry and understand it a little better than the average person, I see it's about education and whether or not they're getting all the facts. And I'm not saying that all GMO is wonderful, and I'm not saying it's all bad. I mean, there's some of it that has to be done. I mean, look, you know, we're dealing right now in the Chesapeake Bay with oysters, where the native oysters die every 3 years. So they, you know, I remember 10 years ago they were looking to bring in another type of oyster that would not die to this DMX disease. They're doing it all over our food spectrum on products. I wish I had more time to sit down and explain, and I could actually go through and talk about products. And I think the best thing we could do is actually sit down and say, okay, let's look at different things. Let's look at corn. You know, everybody loves sweet corn. Well, everybody thinks when you think of sweet corn, you think of Silver Queen corn. The Silver Queen corn of yesterday is not the same of today. They've been able to keep producing it sweeter and sweeter and higher sugar levels. So now you have this ultra sweet corn that is not the same as what it was 20 years ago, but people in their mind, they still call it Silver Queen corn when it's not that anymore. They've been able to change it and make it sweeter by, and I'm going to use the word genetically altering it. Well, by genetically, what they're doing is they're finding one corn, you know, a couple seed stocks that were pretty sweet. Well, they're going to use that the next time, and you're constantly modifying the breeding pattern and making it a better product.
Well, how do you see the politics of this bill coming through?
I don't know. I'm curious where the Farm Bureau is going to be on this. I'm pretty sure they'll be opposed to it and some of the other groups. Maryland is such a small state that it's going to be tough that when we pass regulations like this, you're buying products from outside the state that are being shipped in. What kind of impact does it have on that? Versus, you know, you take a state like California, when they put down a mandate like this, it's easy for these larger manufacturers to change what they're doing because California is so big. But Maryland being so small, they're not going to change what they do with their labeling practices. So I think it could be a problem on that side of it.
Well, Senator J.B. Jennings, I really appreciate taking the time. I know you have a lot going on today. Senator Jennings, of course, represents the 7th District in Baltimore and Hartford County. Thank you so much for your time today on Soundbites.
Well, thank you, sir.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.